There's a moment early on in The World and All That It Holds, Alexander Hemond's extraordinary new novel, when our protagonist, Pinto, is reflecting on the war in which he is about to be sent off to fight. Hemond writes, "Even before his basic training was over and his regiment deployed to invade Serbia, Pinto understood that there was no sense in fantasizing about different outcomes. Everything that happens is always the only thing that can happen. Everything before this moment leads to this moment." That feeling of being carried relentlessly forward by the tides of fate, of being buffeted by the currents of history, is pervasive in The World and All That It Holds. And yet the novel also never loses sight of the fact that within that fate, beneath that history, there are humans living, humans loving, humans losing, and crucially, humans making decisions, as well as coming to understand the scale at which the decisions they make can count. The World and All That It Holds takes us from Bosnia to Uzbekistan to China and elsewhere, covering a convulsive period of history in which the technological advances, the political turbulence, and the displacement of people bear striking similarities to those of our own time. At its heart, though, not exactly beneath the grand sweep, but entwined with it, is a love story between two men, Pinto and Osman. The World and All That It Holds is the work of a novelist writing at the height of his powers, and I'm delighted to say that Alexander Hemond joins me to discuss it today. Alexander, welcome to the Shakespeare and Company podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
Okay, so where I'd like to begin today is with, I guess, the beginning of the book. Because within the first chapter, you have two, I suppose, momentous occurrences. You have the, I hope this isn't a spoiler, but the assassination of Ferdinand, Archduke Franz Ferdinand in Sarajevo in 1914, the event that is often credited as being the catalyst for the First World War. And then at the same time, on the same day, for our protagonist, Pinto, you have this moment, which I'm not going to spoil by going into it in a lot of detail, but in the apothecary that he runs, where he has a moment of, not exactly of personal revelation, but of personal fulfillment. I'm curious to know, when this book was germinating for you, was there one or the other of these that came to you first? Was it just the character of Pinto and this setting off on the journey, or did you have the idea of writing something that began around the same time as the beginning of the First World War and Pinto and the character and the events grew from that?
Well, to be honest, I can't remember the inception moment of the idea. I know that now it's been 13 years since I sold a book on proposal to my British publisher for some reason, and which means that I had been thinking about it for at least 12 years. I turned it in last year, obviously, the finished book. So I don't remember what I might have thought 13 or 14 or 15 years ago. I do think that the assassination, June 28, 14 in Sarajevo, was the beginning, and that I always thought that Pinto would be there and witness it. And then there was the germ in many ways, because in my first book, there's a story about the assassination, and there's another person present who, in the story is the grandfather of the narrator, who's carrying an accordion. It's a little self-referential moment in the world and all that holds. Because that assassination, it's a crucial thing in the history of Sarajevo and Bosnia and Europe in the end. It also marks the beginning of the 20th century, right? You can measure centuries. Every 100 years, it's a new century. But if you measure, or you think of centuries, measuring them historically, as it were, it is easy, and many historians have made an argument that it started with that assassination and ended in 2001 with 9/11. Because within that period, with that stretch of history, the world in Europe and other parts of the world, but Bosnia is in Europe, changed shape that was then very different from the previous century and from the following century. So it's the beginning of the story of Pinto, but it's the beginning of the story of the 20th century too. That very moment. And in my work, my people live in history. Their bodies are in history. And they're not generals or leaders or, presidents looking out the window trying to make a difficult decision. It is all as you were describing it, at a level of survival, right? At the level of touch and love and food and wet feet, because my body lives in history. Right. History to me is not conceptual. It's not just discourse. Of course, it's discourse too, but it is this thing that does thing to my body.
There seems to be a tension in the concept of history, and I think we'll unpack it a little bit more as the conversation goes on. But particularly concerning this event and this assassination, because As you describe it, and as I've read about it in other books in the past, it's the success, if you like, of the assassination hinged on a few things falling into place by chance. And it could very easily not have happened, and the Archduke, you know, could have survived the attempt. I'd put in mind of the British sitcom Blackadder at the moment, particularly the fourth season, where it's set in the First World War. And at the moment they're talking about what started the war. And Blackadder says, but in the end, it was just too much effort not to have a war. So I'm curious about what you think about this. Do you think that this small event in the grand scheme of things was pivotal? Or do you think it's more the historical context was there, that it was waiting essentially for a spark of some kind, and it happened to be this one?
Well, we will never know, sadly.
Sure. In other worlds, which we will also come on to talk about.
Right. But it's also that, you know, everything that leads to this moment necessitates this moment, and we can't, there's no point in imagining alternative outcomes. Mm-hmm. Or as Lady Macbeth said, what's done cannot be undone. Mm-hmm. And so it is easy to think, and you know, when I was growing up, I lived in socialism, so this Marxist determinism of history, right? That the history is this process that had its own logic and force and just went forth toward a better future in you know, socialist imagination. So there's a strong argument to be made that the world that was marked by the presence of four major empires in the world, and so at the moment of the beginning of the book, much of the world is controlled by four major empires. And it's easy to imagine an argument then that those empires could not be sustained and could not survive the changes in the world, whatever they were, right? And so within 5 years, right, three of those major empires vanished and were broken into smaller countries or changed entirely their social order, because those empires were rooted in the divine right of kings. It was a dominant social order in much of the world that lasted for hundreds of years and seemed the only imaginable possible order. And then it just crashed, which should be a lesson to us now, right? We think, oh, capitalism, America, all that, it will last forever. It could be gone, you know, before our children start going to school or my children to college. And so this inevitability, it's tempting, right? But at the same time, for people who live in history, you don't see it as history. You don't see it as a process. Wherever you may have grown up, you see it as this thing affecting your body, right? And another. There's a moment in the book when Pinto and Osman are in the trenches in 1916 in Galicia and Western Ukraine, and shells are raining upon their heads. But they don't call that the Brusilov offensive, which is what it was, which is how it's remembered in history. It's just shells raining on their heads.
Yeah.
And so the point of contact with history, at least for these characters, is violence. Mm-hmm. And so you cannot sort out violence that is historical or just random. That's not how it works. So you can make an argument that the rotting of the empires, right? And the fourth empire just ended it with Boris Johnson and Brexit in a clown show. And so that, you know, it was necessary, but we will never know. And it's also possible to imagine there would have been alternative ways in which the empires would have disintegrated, but we also will never know. Yeah, and history is both inevitable and it offers endless possibilities at any given moment. Mm-hmm.
When you were going back to research this book, like I made a slightly glib comparison, I guess, in the introduction between the technological changes of that epoch and what we're living through today. And I think there are some interesting parallels to be made. But one thing that really struck me, there was a moment when near the beginning of the book where I think it's some people who come to Pinto's apothecary, and describe them as those ancient peasants look around as if they just disembarked from a ramshackle time machine. And there does seem to be something about this moment, I guess, at this point in the Industrial Revolution and at this maybe particular time and place in Europe, where that clash between a real ancient way of living and the beginning of genuine modernity was perhaps starker than any other historical transition I can think of.
Well, you know, Bosnian, like many other languages, has layers of words that came from different other languages and that are entirely historical. So there are a lot of Turkish words and Arabic and Persian words by way of Turkish, because Bosnia was part of the Ottoman Empire for a few hundred years. And then there's a layer of words that came from German, because Bosnia was occupied by the Austro-Hungarian Empire for 40 years or so. And many of those words are sort of the simple technology, which we would call now simple technology. The words for zipper, the word for zipper to this day is Reißverschluss. The word for screwdriver is Schraubenzieher. And there are all these, you know, words for the parts of a car engine and that are old German, which, and it's hardly surprising, but the Austrian Empire, they, for the purpose of exploitation, not for, you know, for the to help the local population, they build the train system, they cut to build tunnels, they built all these things. And there's a layer in the architecture of Sarajevo and Bosnia that is recognizably Austro-Hungarian, but it's also technological, right? This only happened, it's a relatively short time for a province to be part of an empire, 40 years. Bosnia was occupied in 1878, and it was over in 1918. In those 40 years, or in fact, fewer than 40 years, because, you know, during the war, they didn't quite build railroads. There was a whole layer of technology that is now still recognizable in language. And so Pinto finds himself at that point. What the Bosnia becoming part of the empire also allowed was, well, there were Viennese students. People still refer to some story, talking about significant, you know, historical personalities in the past. They would call them, they would say he was a Viennese student, Bajki student, because there's a whole different system of education as compared to the Ottoman Empire, and so on and so on. So Pinto, this is another reason why I once started the book at that point. He's in that, at that, what do I, watershed moment. Right, which seems to him, before the Archduke is assassinated, the beginning of a new century. The Archduke came in a car that was built in Prague, the Škoda factory, a car. A car as big as a ship. And also, Sarajevans to this day are still proud of it, that the first streetcar, that Sarajevo had a streetcar before Vienna had it. And that's because the Austrians were experimenting with it, not because they like, you know, Bosnians more than the Viennese. And there are pictures of streetcars you can find, or postcards, in fact, streetcars pulled by horses from 1904. So it was a kind of, we would call it cultural shock right now, but that's inaccurate. It's a historical shock. Suddenly, entirely new reality emerges, and it's like a blimp, historically speaking, for 30 years or so, and then it just vanishes. The whole structure just crashes on top of everyone. And that's terrible for, it's still terrible for Bosnians now, let alone what it was like back then, but it's narratively useful, shall we say.
And that's really interesting, that idea as well of the layer of language of technology being wholly imported from the Germanic as well, because that implies it was in no way an organic arrival onto the Bosnian scene. It was just placed down. It was an invasion almost from the top, and you can understand why then that would lead to the frictions in the society, and also frictions in the psyche, when you have this whole sense of concepts and vocabulary just arriving wholesale rather than coming up from the grassroots.
And it came in a shape of the empire. And the Bosnians called, for some reason, Austrians Schwabo. And that's still the word for German-speaking people, slightly derogatory.
Right.
How Schwabia was connected to all that, right? And so people still tell, you can still find stories about the things that the Schwabo did, that the German did, or the Austrian did. And I have never been in Sarajevo, but there's a old town, this was built during the Ottoman Empire. It looks very much the Charshia, like the Charshia in Istanbul. Although I've never been there, but my sister, who is an expert on such things, she says, yes, it's much the same. And it's common in all the countries and cities that at some point were part of the Ottoman Empire. And then you cross, and there's literally a line where an art group created an installation on the ground, on the pavement that's, you know, points to the east and points to the west. And you cross the line from east to west, because you cross from the old Ottoman Charshia downtown with wooden shops where the old he was, where his father had the old farmers, and then you cross in the Austrian thing. And then if you keep going, you get into socialism.
Right.
And then you get into, you know, capitalism, which is the obvious part of the city.
Yeah. Let's just dwell a little bit on Sarajevo, because even though without giving too much away, the book begins there and doesn't really get back there for its duration, the city hangs over the book in a very, very profound way. Now, at a moment, it's described as the city behind God's back. And so I just wonder, you've already given us a bit of context about Sarajevo and about its history, but could you just expand a little bit on that idea for maybe listeners who haven't a particular knowledge of the city?
Well, I mean, it's a translation of a Bosnian idiom.
Oh, really?
And if something is, you know, far away from everything, it's behind God's back. Uh-huh. And the other idiom along the same lines is, you know, where God said goodnight. And I added, and never came back in the morning. But there's this, it's a tragic sense, and this is sustained to the history of Sarajevo and Bosnia, both the sense that this, as far as the Western centers of power, it is always on periphery. And historically, it was on the periphery. It was the westernmost province of the Ottoman Empire. And there was the easternmost province in the Balkans, certainly, of the Austro-Hungarian Empire. And the recent troubles are partly rooted in that, because the populations were changing empires, right, without leaving their village ever. And so, which on the upside led to a multicultural, multilingual communal living by necessity, because, and this important aspect of the character of Pinto, right? He's of Sephardic background because his family came from the Iberian Peninsula, who knows how, to the westernmost province of the Ottoman Empire, because the Ottoman Empire, after the Jews were expelled from the Iberian Peninsula at the end of the 15th century, absorbed much of that population. They did not discriminate against them. You know, there were ghettos and ethnically organized neighborhoods, but they were not, you know, there was no prosecution, right? And in the way there was in the Catholic countries or Christian countries. So then Pinto also is a Viennese student, so he speaks German, right? He also speaks Bosnian. And there are all these other people who speak various dialects and various languages at the same time. So this multi, how would I put it? The multitude of possibilities in such a context, right, is related to the fact that Bosnia was always on the fringes of empires and historical events. But at the same time, you know, empires start falling apart at the edges, right? Or if you historically look, the trouble starts at the edges. The Goths came to Rome from the edges of the Roman Empire, right? There are all of these conspiracies and coups in the history of Roman Empire or the Turkish Empire or the Austro-Hungarian Empire. You know, that the court conspiracies, that's one thing. But when the people from the fringes start coming in or leaving, going to the other side, that's when the empire changes shape and the center then shakes too, possibly. And that's Pinto and Osman, and not just in Sarajevo, but throughout the book, they're always on the fringe of some imperial or colonial project, right? At no point are they in anything resembling a functioning society or nation state or anything, right? Or with a place that has a government that is stable or, you know, takes into consideration the welfare of the population. They're moving through a perpetually unstable historical context.
One thing that puts me in mind of actually is when I was reading, there was a sense of, you know, having grown up in the UK and having been taught the history of the early 20th century from a very Western European centric point of view, it really did strike me that this is the story of what was going on in the East was something that was very neglected in the teaching of the First World War and afterwards in Britain, or at least in Britain of the 1990s. I can't speak for how it is now. But and then based on what you just said as well, it seems almost that perhaps, could we say that part of the project is not a great word, but of the novel was in a sense to center the fringes, to show that there is an importance and, you know, a significance to what goes on in these fringes. And for the people who are living there, the fringes are the center. And it's important to remember that.
Yes, absolutely. I mean, from the very beginning, and this I know for sure, they were always going to go east. So Sarajevo is the westernmost point in their travel, right? And they keep going east all the way to Shanghai, precisely for that reason. And for a long time, I thought there would be no Americans at all in it. Just America is too far west. But then, you know, Henry
but
Krantz.
But then the world is round. That's the thing.
So I found out recently. And so then Henry Krantz showed up in the elevator. So I think, you know, The concept of history has dominated Western thought and then by extension other countries. History is generated and organized and conceptualized around power and therefore the centers of power. history happens in the imperial capital, right? And then it has the ripples reach the far out fringes eventually, right? And so, I mean, we can have a separate podcast about all that and the colonial underpinning of that proposition and everything. Sure. But I'm not a historian. But what interests me is that where, if my body needs to survive, my body is the center of history for people, right? If Pinto and Osman are in the trenches in Galicia, they are on the fringes of life, which is far more difficult situation than the fringes of an empire. And because I guess if we think, or if people think, that a country or an empire by definition has porous borders because it's not organized around citizenship, but around territory. So they don't have to convince Bosnians that they're Austrians when they occupy Bosnia. They don't care what language they speak as long as they obey the social order and pay the taxes and, you know, submit to exploitation. So whereas nation states, everyone on this side of the border is French. They speak French. And then there's a cut and they're Germans on the other side. And so the fringes are porous and therefore are always part of some contest, right? The scenes and the whole section of the book takes place in Tashkent. It's part of the great game. There are books and books about the great game, the rivalry between the Russian and the British Empire, right? Mm-hmm. But what they were fighting over were the fringes from their point of view, right? Who's going to get Central Asia? Who's going to get Afghanistan, right? It's thousands of miles from the courts, right? And they don't care about local population. They just want the territory.
Yeah.
And so for me, I wanted not to prove a point about the organization of history in Western discourse, but the fact that history is everywhere at the same time. Mm-hmm. Right. And the hierarchy of importance, it does not quite work for people who are trying to survive or get back home. There's a, you know, a manner of approaching human experience, scientifically or historically, reducing it to phenomena, right? Mm-hmm. Where Pinto, Osman, or Bosnians like myself and my family are statistical occurrences. Right. A certain amount of population went over there and a certain amount of population died. Mm-hmm. And that's not how I experience history or life. I mean, how people who have no access to power experience history or life. Mm-hmm. And my entire work is about that. And not because I went to grad school, but because that's how history affected my, which I did, but because that's how history affected my, everyone I know.
And I think one of the ways that that's conveyed in the novel, and indeed I think in probably any successful novel in a sense, is through the power of the character in a way, you know, so that the character of Pinto doesn't become a historical statistic or a historical symbol. We need to believe in him. We need to get to know him. We need to get to perhaps to like him, or to, you know, to like or loathe, either way. In this case, Pinto, I think we come to love him. But could you talk a little bit about how you got to know Pinto? Was it a character that came to you quite fully formed? Did you hear his voice and he just had to transmute him onto the page? Or was it a more step-by-step process?
It was entirely step-by-step. I mean, I like to compare writing a novel to building a cathedral with toothpicks, from toothpicks, and which takes a long time, I imagine. And probably use toothpicks too, not brand new stack toothpicks. You have to pick the toothpicks and glue them together. It's endless. I had conceptualized Pinto early on, obviously. He was Sephardic. He was educated. He was multilingual. He was Sarajevan, very importantly, obviously. And he was contemplative, a poetic soul, right? Mm-hmm. And the proposal that I mentioned earlier, he and Osman were just friends. Mm-hmm. And I can't remember exactly when or exactly. It wasn't a single moment, but gradually I realized that it would be better narratively and also in terms of my engagement with the characters if they were lovers. Mm. And then he became a gay identity that was not available at the time. So sure. It's a little awkward, but I use the word homosexual. Mm-hmm. This is how I work and imagine stories. I put a character that has some shape within some narrative domain, say Sarajevo, June 28, 1914. And then what? You let them be there and see. And I imagine what they would feel, what they would see, what they would think, what would attract them. And that to me, this which inhabiting another person, but not as fully formed, but inhabiting them in moments, right? And so if I was looking for in research, this is the kind of thing that I assume some novelists at least do, I needed to find out what weather was, what was the weather like on June 28th, 1914. And so I can't remember where I found it, but I tracked it down. It was a sunny day. So then the sun comes to the window, right? And then I had to look up what time was, you know, the Archduke moving around town. Yeah. I don't remember now where it was. I think it was an afternoon, right? Mm-hmm. And so then I imagine where, and no one would notice the difference. Then I would imagine what angle the sun rays would be there. And then if you have sun rays coming through the windows, then what if there's something written on the windows? And then what shadow would that throw on the floor? And then what floor would they have there? And you get that those are the toothpicks. And it takes more than 12 years to build.
Yes.
I do not recommend it generally to young writers. Yeah, that's totally obsessive.
Well, I mean, but the result perhaps justifies the work involved. And actually, this I was going to ask you at the end, but just you describing the levels of obsessive research there puts me in mind of James Joyce. And then, of course, you were one of our readers in our Ulysses project last year. You described yourself as a Ulysses fanatic. And there is in this character, you know, he's a passing character, but there is the only other Jew in the regiment that Pinto serves in is called Bloom. It's spelled differently.
Yeah.
But I just wanted to check in whether that was a deliberate nod to Joyce and your fanaticism.
It was. It was also, I know, I the biggest state company in the history of Bosnia and Yugoslavia was run by someone called Emeric Bloom, who was a heroic person in our family because both of my parents worked for the company. And so when Rahela goes back to Sarajevo toward the end of the book, she runs into a Bloom. And it's a bleak reference to that guy, but absolutely to Leopold Bloom. Bachelor's thesis was on Ulysses, and I just needed to write a paper of 25 pages. That was a bachelor's thesis, but I got so obsessed that I worked on it for a year and a half. and then I had unfolding schemes and graphs of leitmotif chains, and it was 75 pages. This was, mind you, this is how old I am, written on a typewriter, no computer. So I had to repaint the page with all the typos and editing things. So that's how I became a Joyce fanatic. And from those days, I've always been, I mean, it's nothing but a collection of details processed through human consciousness. And so Dublin appears in their consciousness. It could be reconstructed from their consciousness on that particular day. But I think that killed me, the story that killed me, the famous story when James sent his brother Stanislaus to 7 Eccles Street to see if one could jump over the fence.
Yes.
Who would know? Who would know? But I love that so much. It's a thing that I would do.
Yeah.
My sister wouldn't do it though. She would say, go fuck yourself. But wisely, but Stanislaus jumped over the fence and reported, you know, yes, you can do it. So Leopold Bloom jumps over the fence, 7 Eccles Street.
Yeah. Which is interesting, brings us back to what you were saying about the research and the weather and things like that. And it also puts me in mind of, the director's name is escaping me now. The director of Funny Games.
Michael
Haneke.
Haneke, yes.
And I remember seeing an interview with him, and he said he was talking about how, for example, on one of his sets, if there's a collection of books, if he thinks the character would have alphabetized them, he will make sure they are alphabetized. And he said, even if, you know, they are never, the camera never focuses on them, it's something the audience won't notice. It's something which adds to the general sense of the scene. And from the way you described your research about Sarajevo, for example, on that day, it sounds like that's important to you as well. Like, you might not notice it, but you feel it.
Well, yes, because I mean, this really goes back to this, what I was saying earlier, a body in history, right? And so I experienced my life primarily through my senses first, right? Which I then conceptualize and organize in narratives, right? And so, and as we all know, that a lot of memories are a form of narrative, right? Organized around sensory stimulations or involuntary memories, but also general memory of being in Paris in 2018, what it was like. And so to be in the world means to be in the world with your body. And then that body is also a consciousness. And so for me to be able to imagine and inhabit a character, I had to know what they had for breakfast, mm-hmm. if they're having breakfast in the book, right? And so it doesn't matter. It could be, you know, hot dogs, or it could be steak. But whatever it is the same, along the same lines as Michael Haneke, right? I need mm-hmm. to understand them, but not their ethics and philosophy, generalities that mm-hmm. they would present in some kind of like discourse situation. Mm-hmm. But what, if they're itchy, what part of body is itchy? Mm-hmm. And these are the toothpicks. And this is how one temporarily and imaginatively becomes someone else while mm-hmm. writing. And if that works, then I hope that the reader can not relate to the character, but also find a way to imaginatively inhabit that character. Mm-hmm. And inhabit them as they are, not in terms of the overlapping generalities. We all human, of course we are. Yeah. So to me, what is universal is not typicality, mm-hmm. but it is the specificity of experience, what Danilo Kish referred to as the multitude of details that constitute a human life. Mm-hmm. Right, we all have genetically, we are identical, regardless of race and glands and all that. Right, I mean, but the minor differences constitute our mm-hmm. bodies as we are. So you and I are different; they would not confuse us. You are handsome, and I am not. but also, in terms of experience, right? Everyone had mm-hmm. parents. Everyone had a place where they were born. Everyone lived somewhere for a little while. Everyone liked certain things and doesn't like other things. I mean, food and drinks and whatever. And so collecting those details, those toothpicks of existence mm-hmm. is how I construct human consciousness. And mm-hmm. then when I build that house enough or that cathedral with toothpicks, I can get inside it, as mm-hmm. it were, while I'm working on it. And once they are sufficiently built, and this is a crucial point for me in my work, I start loving them. Mm-hmm. I mean, loving them, I want to see what else they can do and how else yes. do they live in the world. And I love them. I find more things to love in them, and not love them because they're like pets. Mm-hmm. But I don't want to sound pretentious or, you know, ambitious, but the way the creator loves what they created.
Sure. Yeah, yeah.
And then they reach an autonomy in which it's not because I created them. That is the really point of unmooring, where there's a logic to their life and consciousness that I just have to respect.
Yeah, right? Yeah, yeah.
And follow wherever they go.
Is there an added challenge? Like, we talked a lot about the sense of the body in history, and of course the what Pinto and Osman go into, the experience of fighting in the First World War, which was, I mean, I don't know if it was uniquely barbaric, but it was certainly, you know, the first mechanized war. It reached a certain level of barbarism, which wars, at least up to that point, had not reached. Where is, you know, you're talking about getting to know a character by what they've had for breakfast, where they're itching, but getting to know that character, to write that character in a situation so extreme, which one has not necessarily experienced as a writer. Is it that groundwork in the past of getting inside them that then allows you to project into that unknown, the situation?
Yeah, absolutely. So, you know, it's all done by way of imagination. I have not experienced war at all, but I have had friends who were in trenches mm-hmm. recently in Bosnia, and then I read books. And then there's a cultural and historical knowledge of what it was like, including, mm-hmm. this, which I also read, the trench warfare in, you know, in Galicia in 1916 and the Brusilov offensive. A million soldiers died in that operation. It's mm-hmm. inconceivable. It was exceptionally brutal compared to the previous war. The biggest previous war was the French-Prussian War in 1871. Right. Was yeah. 700, I think it's, let's say 750,000, it could be 150,000 people killed. Whereas in World War I, it's more than around 20 million, I think. Mm. It's inconceivable. There's no precedent for that. Second World War had a precedent, which was the First World War. Mm-hmm. But the leap, which is directly related to the leap technology, what we talked about earlier, it was just wiping out entire populations. Mm-hmm. Right? 25% of the British officer corps died in World War One. There's all Oxford boys and Cambridge boys, yeah. right? They're privileged. And then, not statistically known populations from different towns and different territories. And so to put them in that situation, that is, believe me, it's not easy for a writer. I also interviewed Bosnians who were in the war for a different project. So I had an idea of some of those things. It's not even the details. I mean, disembowelment. Imagine disembowelment is not that great, but also it's not that hard.
Yeah, right.
You just bowels leave the body, right? That, you don't want to get into the details of the anatomy exactly, right? It is imaginable enough. But then I had to spend time in the trench and then had to go through all that and had to, you know, that's why it took 12 years. You couldn't just do it every day, get up in the morning, have coffee. Let me write some, you know, trench warfare today. Then I'll go and watch a soccer game. They had made love like this before in a trench in the woods, on a haystack in the barracks bathhouse where everyone was naked anyway. The first time, the night after Pinto had offered him a drink, shortly before they were sent to war in Serbia, Osman simply slipped into his bunk after everyone else in the barracks had fallen asleep. He nudged Pinto for space, and when Pinto moved over, he put his arm across his chest and his face against his neck as if to sniff him. They had touched, as if inadvertently, locked eyes and smiled at each other, which inescapably made the hair on the back of Pinto's neck bristle. But before Osman had slipped into his bunk, everything could have been denied, interpreted as excessive sold-out friendship, as a joke, a misunderstanding. That first time, however, there could be no misinterpretation of Osman's moving his hand onto Pinto's stomach, then kissing his temple as Pinto, petrified with possibilities, stared at the underside of the upper bunk where various sold-out names were carved in. He then turned to face and kiss Osman, and while the innocent Bosnians snored and grunted around them, they touched all the parts of each other they could reach without undressing. When the windows paled with a new day and Osman returned to his bed, Pinto stayed awake and embalmed in the haze that follows pleasure and spent the time before they all had to rise worrying that Osman would avoid him, maybe even hate him for what they'd done, denying that it had ever happened. But he found courage later that day to approach Osman and say, "How come you never tell me any stories?" To which Osman said, "We are bound to spend a lot of time together. I'll tell you every story I know." Before the day was out, Osman traded his bunk and moved above Pinto and would slip down night after night until their unit was deployed to Serbia. They slept together in holes in the ground, shared their food and water. Osman was a plain Jäger, Pinto a Sanitätssoldat, or as everyone in the company called him, the Hetchen, never Dr. Rafo. When they got separated in a battle, or Pinto stayed behind in the field hospital, a cannonball of worry would grind his intestines until Osman returned unharmed. There was a day in Serbia when Osman got separated from the patrol he was in, and Pinto nearly lost his mind, searching through the pile of corpses ready to be burned, unwrapping the mauled face of a soldier who had a hole in his sock to discover it was not Osman. And when he came back the following day, limping and using his rifle as a staff, Pinto wept, pressing his face against Osman's chest. By the time they made it to the trenches of Galicia, Osman's telling stories to Pinto was no longer necessary for their coupling. There was no way of denying what was presently happening either. Whatever world and imperial army surrounded them tonight receded into the long darkness, so Pinto could turn his face to Osman and open his mouth to receive his tongue. Derkenda suddenly sat up, and the two lovers froze, holding their breaths until he looked around in some confusion. The adepsis that he was, shouted at his dream enemy a promise that he would fuck his dead mother and lay back down. "He's dreaming," Osman whispered. "So am I," Pinto said. There had to be other soldats who knew what Osman and Pinto were doing, as there must have been others who did it too, and still others for whom two men fucking was so unimaginable they wouldn't believe it possible even if it was to be happening right before their very eyes. At first, Osman was more cautious than Pinto because he claimed he wanted to get married after the war and have children to acquire what all normal people, he said, called a proper life. But after war devoured all they'd known and were sure of, all of the peaceful future they could imagine, it was Osman who always sought excuses to get away from other soldats so he could touch and kiss Pinto, get inside him to come in groans and grunts and screams that scared forest animals and attracted curious peasant children they had to bribe with dry bread and cigarettes to stay silent. And it was Osman who suggested that they share the Untertritt, But Dirk Kemda and Smail Tokmak, not only because they were endlessly loyal, but also because it was obvious that they would never believe their ears and eyes, even if they saw Pinto and Osman fucking. The four of them were a family now. Osman and Pinto, the parents, the two peasants, their not-so-bright children.
There's one moment where you write that the pampered city boys who could not bear the boredom and blistered feet and infections and bullet-torn flesh, so they threw themselves at death as if it would cure it all. And that is set in, almost in contrast to Pinto and Osman. And there is this sense, and this perhaps comes back to a little bit what you were talking about earlier about living on the fringes, that when you've never had that stability and that framework of the luxury of, you know, the so-called pampered city boys, that it's not so much that the conditions of the trenches become more bearable, but that you're in some way better adapted to those extreme conditions.
Well, I mean, if your life is in survival mode before the war,
right,
then it continues to be in survival mode in the war. And those for whom a life before the war was a life of relative or total privilege, they have a harder time adjusting, mm-hmm. right? There's also total randomness of the war. That's the horrible point of the war, that there's no way to predict who's going to live and who's going to die. So everyone wants to live and they want to kill everyone else so they could survive. That's the energy of war. Mm-hmm. But people position themselves in relation to the instances of the world, you know, differently. And this is what individualizes us too, right? And so mm-hmm. it's something that I try to explain to my students. You walk into a room full of other people and take different seats, and then everyone sees that room differently while we are all sharing the experience. It's a basic, you know, not paradox, but the tension in human life. We all so highly individualized, think there's no one like me in the world. And of course, you look around and everyone is exactly like you, while also not being like you at all. And so this negotiation between typicality, universality, and the need to belong to a group and identify yourself in some social hierarchy, and also thinking, well, there's no one like me in the world. And I don't mean this in terms of superiority, but in terms of combination of details, right? No one has had these thoughts before because they have never been, no one else has been in my body before. And so I the whole logic of my writing is to put people in situations and imagine how they would react. Mm-hmm. But imagining both from the point of view of my individual experience, what would I do there, right? But also, if they're sufficiently built, what would they do there? Mm. How would they behave? I have no idea what I would do if shells start raining on top of my head. Yeah. Of course, I like to think that I would be brave and this and that, but later I would just be terrified and paralyzed. I would not be able to think at all. I mean, it's a strange reaction. And so finding that shape of someone else, and while who also contains some part of you by necessity, because it's the language that comes from my head, mm-hmm. is the challenge. And to me, writing fiction, at least, is always extending you from personal space into other people's space, into public space, and then into the unknown, whatever is beyond that. I mean, it's not the same process. It's not just ripples, but in different directions.
Yeah. One thing that, I mean, maybe in a sense it could be considered just a detail in the book, but it really struck me is the line where you write, since the war had begun, Pinto had been fully cured of the desire to write poetry. And you spoke earlier, you described him as a poetic sensibility. And I think there is a tendency perhaps among writers and amongst readers and amongst book lovers to hold up this poetic sensibility, the creative sensibility as being something that if one was to lose it at the moment, one would want to get back at some point. And yet I found with Pinto this, you know, well, the word cured is a fascinating choice in itself. Like, it's something which he doesn't regret once it's gone, in a way. There's always something which is not to dismiss the value of poetry or art, but just perhaps in the, I don't know, in the context of what happens in his life, he recognizes the inherent luxury rather than the essentialness of it?
Well, I mean, depends how, that's a very interesting question. There's some other, at some other point, he says something like his desire to write poetry evaporated like a tear in the sun, which of course could be in a poem, right? That line, mm-hmm. because he's cured of desire to write poetry, but his mind is still poetic. Mm-hmm. And so you can think of a poetry as a public exercise or public expression of inner thoughts or engagement with language, for which you need an audience, you need response, and you need discourse, and you need publishing, and you need bookstores and all that. And that, it's not available because it's part of a social structure that is not available to him after that. And to write Poetry in the Trenches presumes that there will be a life after this where you could do all that poetry stuff, have readings in Vienna cafes and all this.
Right.
But if you think, if one thing of poetry, like storytelling, it's a essential human need, a way to organize and conceptualize experience, right? In other words, to be a storyteller, you don't have to write stories. To be a poet, you don't have to write poetry, right? I believe firmly that we organize experience by way of narratives and by way of language, including organizing language in what, if written and published, would look like poetry, right? In images, in metaphors, in metonymical structures, right? So he retains his poetic, reflective engagement with the world, right? And his obsession with languages, several languages, while the whole operation, indulgent operation of poetry as fine art is no longer available because there's no world in which that poetry could be read by someone else.
That obsession with languages is fascinating. And I think from just a technical point in the book as well, that the novel is in English and was written in English. And yet there's something, and I'm not quite sure how you do it, that we feel the presence of lots of different languages. Like you drop words in here or there, words which we may not know where they're from, but we understand their meaning in context. But it felt like, I can only imagine it must have been quite a technical challenge to have a book which is so replete with languages and dialects, and some of them public, some of them pigeons, some of them just between small groups of people, and still maintains a coherent whole for the reader.
Well, I always wanted him, as I was saying earlier, I always wanted him to be multilingual, that is to have a multilingual consciousness. And I assume you're multilingual, and at least
bilingual.
Multilingual, fine. But you have to be monolingual is to have a multilingual mind is multidimensional. Mm-hmm. Let's put it that way. But I will also say, and this is crucial for Pinto and also for a way to read the book, that while working on this and imagining Pinto and his situation, and talking to people and reading up and all that, there's a notion in linguistics of macaronic language. The easiest and best and most available example is that immigrants in a new country, they will combine within the same sentence the words from two or more languages.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, yeah.
It's available in a situation of intimacy and where people are, people will want to hear what you want to say. And it's also functional, like, give me that thing over there. And you can't think of the word for that thing in English, and then you use the Bosnian word, or you're speaking Bosnian to your friends and you can't think of the word in Bosnian for that thing, and then you use that word, right? And over time, those words that macaronic structure becomes the language. I mean, English became macaronic in the 12th century, right? And as I was saying earlier, the layers of Bosnian words, right? There was no word in Bosnian for Strafzieger. And so macaronically, they would insert the German word for Strafzieger, because who's going to, while fixing something and working on it, who's going to try to think of a proper word for the Bosnian word for the Strafzieger?
Right.
So a multilingual mind is inherently macaronic because, in fact, there are studies that show that a multilingual or multilingual mind processes language and reality somewhat differently. Mm-hmm. Because it tests possibilities, which word is appropriate here. And so I wanted Pinto to have not only a multilingual mind, but a macaronic mind. Mm-hmm. Because to him, there's no difference between those words. It's all the languages of his consciousness. Mm-hmm. And so to translate that or to italicize foreign words means that there would be hierarchy of languages in his consciousness, right? Mm-hmm. Right. And it was somewhat risky, I knew, because, that people will complain, well, look at these foreign words here. We don't like foreign words in English language, right? But English doesn't have foreign words as such, right? But I thought, why not? Mm-hmm. It's also true that there are probably under 1,000 foreign words or sentences in the sentences, or fewer sentences, obviously, but foreign words, foreign non-English words, all of them are foreign to me, non-English words in the book, which is more than 100,000 words, less than 1%. And I find it strange. I'm too vain, so I can't resist reading comments online. It torments me daily, but people complain about all these languages. Some people complain about the language because they just, why do that, right? Mm-hmm. But without that, there's no Pinto.
Yeah. You used the term multidimensional, and it struck me that one of the, I guess, one of the recurring motifs in the book is this idea of, I suppose, a slightly paradoxical idea of this is the only possible world. It's like when I asked you to speculate on if the, you know, Archduke hadn't been assassinated, you're like, well, there's not really much point because he was assassinated. And yet there's this idea, I guess, from, if I remember rightly, from the stories that Pinto was told as a boy about the Holy One kept creating worlds and destroying them until arriving at this one. And it's that sense of, that opens up a sense of possibility, but also a sense of inevitability in a way. And I was wondering if you, well, I suppose this is a double-pronged question, if you could expand a little bit on this, the importance of this idea of the many worlds to the novel and to Pinto. And also, and this is perhaps a question you could dismiss out of hand, but a lot of people will know that recently you worked on the most recent Matrix film. And of course, there is something, I suppose, a certain parallel to be drawn between these ancient legends that Pinto is referring to and the multidimensional worlds that we encounter in modern science fiction films like The Matrix.
That's a great question or questions. Well, I think, there's an idea that perhaps there are simultaneously existing multiple worlds which are mutually exclusive. That is, you can't be in both of them. We are in this one, and there's someone just like us, perhaps, in the next one. But I like the idea. This comes from the Talmud or the Talmudic thought that God, in Christianity also, it's common that, you know, we think that, well, I don't think, I'm not Christian, but people think that God created this world. That's it. Mm-hmm. It's the best of possible worlds. And God would not be, you know, experimenting, because God would know how to make a perfect thing, right, by virtue of being perfect. But in Talmud, for some theological reason that I, you know, cannot fully get into, or because I don't really know, the idea that God would create one world and just arbitrarily destroy it, why not? And then create another one and arbitrarily destroy it, and why not? It is interesting to me, particularly since it really fits the structure of the book and Pinto's experience of life. Here's the world, a century of progress, right? A handsome officer in his apotheque, and the Archduke is in outside coming, you know, to our town behind God's back. Everything looks great. Boom, it's all gone. Mm-hmm. In a minute, right? And then they're in the trenches of Lidse. It's not great, the world, obviously. But even that ends, and then another one begins. And the book is structured, really, with chapters that are, or sections that are discrete, in which there are sharp cuts between periods and experiences, and if you wish, the worlds, right, that are built there. And that is important. It's something that I dealt with in my other book. Displaced people, traumatized by violence, individually or collectively, they see their experience and the world as fragmented, as broken, as shattered. And then to organize that or reorganize, restore some order, I guess storytelling is one of the ways where you string those fragments into some sequence, and there are gaps and holes and ruptures, and you can't, it's never going to be smooth again. But that's how you do it. But it also, one's self-perception, right? If we live in a stable society, in the same city or country or whatever, Western world, your entire life without being traumatized individually or collectively, then you can imagine easily that there's a continuity in your own life. Mm-hmm. That you're the same person you were at the age of four. Mm-hmm. And then you build the story of your life or construct the story of your life around that continuity, right? But I know that I was not the way I, at the age of four, the way I am now, because when I was four, that was before the war in Bosnia. And now I'm 58. And there are all other bodily differences. But in terms of the continuity is ruptured. And imagine being in the war, losing people. What's happening in Ukraine now, right? This whole cities are destroyed, with entire families wiped out, right? To build that continuity and say, well, I've always been the same person, that doesn't work. And so a lot of my work is structured in that, dealing with fragmentation, right? Mm-hmm. Pushing it to the edge of organization, but then also pushing it back so that fractured, fragmented structure is retained. And so this, you know, Talmudic idea that God creates and restores world, destroys and then builds a new one, destroys and builds a new one, that entirely complies with my experience, but certainly Pinto's.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And that also brings me on to, I think it's probably going to have to be the final thing we talk about today because we're running out of time. But there's a third type of experience in a way. So you described like the people who live their entire lives with a certain consistency, one world without this fragmentation. Then you have people who are, which may have been your experience, which is a sense of consistency up until the moment of fracture. And then in the book, we have Rahela, who is, without going into too much detail, essentially Losman's daughter. We won't go into how exactly that comes to pass. And Rahela, well, at the moment you say, the child had been a refugee all of her life and had endured displacement without complaining. And this is a sense of like, this is somebody who never had the stability to be fragmented in the first place, I suppose. And one thing that I suppose is quite inspiring, or at least hopeful in the story, is Rahela and is the life force that she possesses and the way she is able to be in a fragmenting world in a way that, again, without going into too much detail, Pinto struggles with through the entire book and looks for ways to appease it. Is in that sense, is Rahela perhaps the fundamentally modern character in the book? Like, she is the one most suited to inhabit the world, perhaps it is becoming the 21st century.
Well, yes. But also in the more metaphysical sense, she's an embodiment of love between Pinto and Osman,
right?
And which is why she's their daughter. And this is, despite all these worlds crashing and rising, one continuity through those cyclical catastrophes is love between Osman and Pinto, and then a love as embodied by Rahela, not biologically embodied, but she's imbued with their love in ways that we'll not describe. And so I wanted to, when in the original imagining of the proposal that I wrote, they were friends and their longing was for Sarajevo and they kept going away from it, but they kept longing for the city until it became entirely mythological, like reverse El Dorado. And so, but then I realized, and it was kind of a steady pitch of nostalgia, be rising until it became delusional. And that was not quite, I don't know why I was thinking, but this was more appealing to me that if they were lovers, then their love, they would long for each other. Mm. And by extension, Sarajevo, perhaps. But this longing could get them through the worlds that are crashing and rising. And then that allowed for the presence of Rahela in the narrative, who is this child that survives only because they love her. Mm-hmm. There's no protective structure around her at any time, other than love of Pinto and Osman by extension. And so this was what I ended up with when I changed my mind about the structure, that we would not be friends, but lovers. And so that love is the stable thing, right? And it's, I guess, let me say it, I don't believe in God. I believe that these crashes and of the world crashing and rising, it's history and human inability to sustain things for whatever reason, except in terms of love. We are this paradoxical species that are capable of the horrible, most unimaginable, terrible thing, and capable of loving people in the midst of it all. Mm-hmm. And that's amazing, which is beyond biological. I mean, there's survival and you protect your, you know, young ones to perpetuate the species and all that. But I wanted to diffuse, and it's not that I wanted it, but that is diffused by the fact that Rahela is an embodiment of queer love. She's not a consequence of reproduction between the two of them. She exists because it lives because they loved her, particularly Pinto, and Pinto largely. And I wanted to establish that love can sustain us through all that, nothing else.
And so I guess my final question connected to that, and because we brought up the subject earlier and I did want to come back to it, is this question of home in a way, which, of course, you know, you used the term nostalgia a moment ago. And of course, you know, with Ulysses, again, very much in mind, this idea of the nostos, this idea of the journey home, you know, whether it be Odysseus or whether it be Leopold Bloom or whether it be Pinto. There's sort of, is there in some way, I guess, the great Venn diagram, a mapping of this concept of love and this concept of home for you? Because Rahela, in a sense, doesn't have a home in the way that a physical home, a city or a house, in the way that many of us conceive of home. And yet, in a strange way, of all of the characters, you know, particularly in the late stages of the book, she is the most at home of them all.
Well, I think if you think of home as a physical place, that it is, how would I put it? That if you don't have access to that place, then there's never, will always be not at home. And of course, that mm-hmm. happens to people a lot. That is, you will never, you might never feel that you're part of any community or group of people outside of that home. And that, of course, happens to people. But it's also true that people leave those places with the ones that they love and then keep going. Mm-hmm. And so, you know, we have all seen the images of people on the boats holding their children. Mm-hmm. And they're risking their lives and the lives of their children, but not because they're cruel or because they want to, you know, I don't know, form the British shores or whatever, but because they love those children and they also want to live. And so it's my little theory of metaphysical theory of migration is that we are biologically inclined to move toward a space in which we believe we'll have greater agency. And I don't mean political agency or money, but I mean where we'll have greater control of our lives. Mm. And in those lives, the primary need is rooted in love. I want my children to live, and I want them to be happy and have food. And have food first and then happy. If they have food and are unhappy, that's better than being happy and not having food. And so this, how would I put it? The context of love and agency was interested me. Pinto is in some ways entirely helpless in the world that constantly crashes and he's but a target for great historical projects, mm-hmm. right? But he's all of his agency in the world, all of his decisions are in some way organized around his love for Rahela, or Osman first, and then Rahela. Mm-hmm. And that what makes him a person of great importance in that world, right? Not a general who sends 100,000 people to die, or, you know, the great genius who constructed a new empire or whatever. But this, to me, this is the amazing things that humans do. We love in ways that other species love their little ones too, but we have a whole world of literature about loving others. Despite all the horrible things that we're doing daily, that is amazing to me.
Yeah. Well, that seems like the perfect place to leave it. As I said at the beginning, The World and All That It Holds is such an extraordinary book. It's such a journey we take with Pinto, Osman, Rahela, and all of the other characters we haven't had time to talk about. I mean, I'm disappointed we didn't get onto Major Moser Ethering, so our readers will have to them on their own accord. Of course, it is available from Shakespeare and Company. We have stacks of it. It's available in the bookstore. It's available from our website. It's available from your local independent bookstore, wherever that may be. Alexander Hemant, thank you so much for joining us today.
Thank you very much. I hope to see you in Paris at the bookstore.
With great pleasure.
Thank you for listening to the Shakespeare and Company podcast. If you've enjoyed this conversation, it would be great if you could help us spread the word by reviewing or rating us in your favorite app, or just by sending the link to your friends. And don't forget, if you'd like even more from Shakespeare and Company, you can subscribe now through Apple Podcasts or Patreon for just €3 a month. Links to both are available in the show notes to this episode. Production of this podcast is all done in-house here at Shakespeare and Company Paris. All music is by Alex Fryman, whose album, Play It Gentle, is available to buy or stream wherever you listen. We'll be back soon. Until then, take care, and thanks again for listening.